Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 26th of November 1922, a real actual card-carrying communist speaks in the House of Commons, a popular thriller writer is shot, young women are warned of the dangers of pretty much everything, everyone is warned about celebrity, and in shock news, communists are caught out in a lie. On Thursday, the King opened Parliament in time-honoured fashion with a speech from the throne. The King's speech was very short, the only item of substance being the bills to enact Irish independence. The first major speech was made by Ramsay MacDonald, who was the newly elected leader of the Labour Party and, as such, the leader of His Majesty's loyal opposition. This is what he had to say. This is from Friday the 24th. The important statement in the speech after Ireland relates to unemployment. That statement is to us profoundly unsatisfactory. Labour cheers. There is no sense of proportion in it, and there is no real appreciation of the terrible tragedy. The honourable member who moved the address referred to this matter of unemployment in very simple and in very true and penetrating words. I hope that the charm of his name is... This is a joke, the guy's name was Brass, anyway, he goes on. The charm of his name, which has acted with such miracles in Clitheroe, will... Clitheroe being his constituency. Actually, they didn't call it constituencies in those days, they called them divisions. Anyway, Clitheroe will be exercised upon the government, so that his free trade speech may have due weight with the government in devising the administrative changes and legislation which we shall expect in pursuance of this paragraph in the speech. But the speech says the ameliorative measures prepared by the late government are being examined afresh. We are not interested in ameliorative measures, or the measures prepared by the late government. We are interested in the blunders of the late government which created the conditions. Labour cheers. After all these ameliorative measures, and after all the millions of pounds that have been spent upon them, the streets today witness the procession of the unemployed, and the official records show that 1,300,900 people are still requiring those ameliorative measures. I'd love to be able to explain why unemployment is as high as it is in 1922, but I don't know. Post-war conditions, the high pound, high interest rates, the fact that unemployment benefit is a new thing, and if you pay people well, they're going to, you know, take advantage of it. I'm not necessarily talking about fraud, but that might be one of the things that's going on. Anyway, I don't know. I'd be interested to know, but I don't. In his reply, the Prime Minister, Andrew Bonar-Law, expressed hopes that the Anglo-Irish Treaty would work and said that better trade was the answer to unemployment. A little later, a Mr. Newbold took to his feet. Walter Newbold was the member for Motherwell, the communist member for Motherwell, and the only communist at the time in the chamber. He said that his party did not believe that they would ever be enabled to carry their point of view in regard to unemployment constitutionally. Sounds ominous. We believe, he continued, that when the time comes we shall have to deal with your class as the honourable member who once sat for Huntingdon dealt with your predecessors. There are two interesting features about that sentence. I mean, when he talks about the member for Huntingdon, he does not mean John Major. He means Oliver Cromwell, his predecessor. And also, it's interesting that he's using the second person. It is certainly my understanding that you're not allowed to do that in the House of Commons, at least not these days. I presume not in those days either. That seems to be my... This seems... what's the word? This seems jarring. Maybe he's being allowed to. Maybe the Times is writing this up inaccurately. Who knows? Anyway, he goes on. There have been precedents for revolution in this country. There is no country in Europe where there have been so many precedents for civil war as in this country. And if you challenge us again, then we shall be compelled to take up the challenge. He goes on. We are not going to sit down to the scale that was laid down by the Board of Health in the last Parliament. We demand the scale of the National Unemployed Workers Committee. If we do not get it inside this chamber, we shall get it outside. I'm not quite sure what this business about the National Unemployed Workers Committee is. It's it sounds like a communist committee to me, or a communist front. I think those are fairly ominous words, that if we don't get it inside this chamber, we shall get it outside. That certainly seems to be the whole tone of his speech. Trying to get your way outside democratic structures doesn't always work, as this member of the IRA found out. This is also from Saturday. The strange and tragic career of Erskine Childers came to an end this morning within 14 hours after his council's failure to secure reprieve from the courts of the king whom he defied in arms. The following official report was issued today from the headquarters of the National Army. Official. Mr. Erskine Childers was tried by a military court at Portobello Barracks, Dublin, on November the 17th, 1922, and charged with having possession without proper authority of an automatic pistol when apprehended by a party of national forces on November the 10th, 1922, at Animo House, County Wicklow. The accused was found guilty and sentenced to death. The finding and sentence were duly confirmed, and the execution was carried out this morning at 7 o'clock. There was a feeling in Dublin, perhaps as a result of certain British appeals for clemency, that the death penalty would not be inflicted, and the city has been deeply stirred and indeed awed by this execution. It is recognised now that the provisional government has staked everything on the restoration of law and order, and there is no doubt that its resolute action will increase public confidence in the future of the Free State. In an editorial, the Times summed it up. This is also from Saturday. The Free State government have made their choice with a courage certainly not inferior to that of their adversaries, and with a responsibility far graver. We believe that the verdict of the civilised world upon their decision will be that it was right. I've been spending the last couple of days trying to figure out if the verdict of history is that that decision was right or wrong or not. Difficult to say. Spoiler alert, the national forces win the Irish Civil War and the IRA is at least temporarily crushed. However, in the 1930s, the IRA effectively get back in and Ireland becomes, to all intents and purposes, I think it actually officially becomes a republic, and a few years later it leaves the Commonwealth. So, who won that one? Well, I mean, they didn't get Ulster, of course. And I don't think there's ever any prospect, you know, whoever won the Irish Civil War of them getting Ulster. Anyway, I shall leave that to the listener. On the subject of Ireland, on Monday, the Times published a report on conditions in West Ireland. Even before this last outbreak of insurrection started, the country had been abandoned to and was entirely in the control of the Irish Republican Army. The Royal Irish Constabulary barracks were vacated and burned. There were no British troops, no officials were allowed to officiate, no Free State control of any sort was even attempted, and so the rule of the IRA prevailed. People were driven from their homes, orders were issued for Protestants to leave the country, motor cars were stolen at will. Not that things are any better in the capital. This is from Friday the 24th. At about 9:30 tonight, very heavy shooting was heard throughout Dublin. It is believed that virtually all the posts of the national troops in the city, including Wellington, Portobello and Beggar's Bush barracks, were attacked. There is also a rumour of an attack on Mountjoy Jail. Heavy firing was directed against the two offices of the Irish Independent, and machine guns were brought into play from the roofs of adjoining houses. Civilians were forced to lie down on O'Connell Bridge for safety, and many narrow escapes are reported. I'm not sure you ever want to lie down on a bridge if you're under fire. You get off that bridge pretty quickly anyway. That's by the by. Another part of the world having difficulties with terrorist groupings is Louisiana. This is from Tuesday the 21st. Newspapers give sensational prominence to reports that Mr. Parker, the governor of Louisiana, who arrived in Washington yesterday, is seeking the help of the president and federal government in dealing with Ku Klux Klan. Notice the absence of a definite article. In many parts of the state, the white-hooded knights, in obedience to strange oaths, are said to be making a mockery of the regular administration of the law. The outrages committed by them, not only in Louisiana but in many other states, are steadily increasing in frequency and audacity. According to Mr. Arthur Brisbane, I'd never heard of this guy, but he's a bit of a sort of newspaper legend. He tended to be tended to work with William Randolph Hearst. I suspect he was the model for the character of Jedediah in what's the movie, Citizen Kane. Well, I'm probably going off a flying off a huge tangent here. Anyway, according to Arthur Brisbane, 60 new members of Congress are members of Ku Klux Klan and promoters of its invisible empire, which is waging war against Jews and Roman Catholics. Jews and Roman Catholics? Is that it? Because I'm pretty sure there's another group they have a go at. But there is far worse than that. This is from Thursday the 23rd. Presiding at the Chester Diocesan Conference yesterday, the Bishop of Chester said he believed we were extraordinarily near to something like idolatry of sport and amusement when one read of a reception given in London to a cinema artist which could hardly be secured by, say, General Foch. One could not help thinking that the country had gone extraordinarily wild and wrong. Really and truly, it was one form of national insanity. No one could deny the extraordinarily sordid motives of ever so much of our recreation. In many departments of recreation, in the background of it all, there was a real meanness which touched the heart of the nation's life. One could not say anything for the wholesale encouragement of organised sport on Sunday. Well, don't say we weren't warned. But there were more warnings to come. This is also from Thursday. Dr. Agnes Saville delivered a lecture on the dangers of society to health at the Institute of Hygiene last evening. Nowadays, she said, the girl dispenses with a chaperone, and even if she retains the old high standard of chastity, her mind too often becomes poisoned, her ideals recede, she accepts the inferior outlook on life, and when she marries, the standard of her relationship to her husband, home and children, is not a high one. What on earth is she talking about? Anyway, she goes on. Society life is responsible for deficient sleep and consequent deterioration of the entire nervous system. It encourages the pernicious habit of the too frequent cigarette. It encourages the girls to take cocktails and whiskies and sodas, which ruin their digestion, impair their livers, and upset the balance of the nervous system. And it encourages them to take rich foods, which upset the rhythm of the body. The ill health of the modern society girls is in a measure the fault of their parents. Blame the parents, who have it in their hands to postpone the downfall of our modern civilization, since civilization itself has its foundation on those individuals who possess the virtues of stability, high purpose, and unselfishness. Which I kind of agree with. At least that very, very last bit. Now, by our standards, this all sounds, well, old-fashioned, judgmental, prescriptive. I'm sure there are better words, but I can't think of them off the top of my head. But Dr. Agnes Saville is not, well, she's no slouch, let's put it like that. She was the first female graduate from St. Andrews University. Obviously, she trained as a doctor. She was a radiographer in the First World War, just like Marie Curie, as it happens. Someone who's thoughtful, who's, studies hard, who's unlikely to come to conclusions just off the top of her head. So, worth listening to, shall we say. Whether that's true or not, she seems to be describing just most teenagers' lives these days, or most young adults' lives. But certainly interesting, shall we say. Somehow I don't think that's going to be a problem in the workers' paradise. This is from Wednesday the 22nd. Russia Today, Businessman's Experience, Soviet Peep Shows. Now, it's not what you think. It really isn't. This is an extract from quite a long article about economic conditions in Russia under the New Economic Policy, or NEP. After an optimistic introduction, the author writes, I was taken to the Sindel factory, cotton mills, and found it well-equipped both in machinery and materials. The factory was working better than I had thought possible under present conditions. But I knew my ground and inquired after other factories around Moscow. I received from the authorities various plausible but always evasive answers. I came across some of my old business friends, and I was told and later proved beyond the shadow of a doubt that this Sindel factory was just a Soviet peep show arranged for the definite purpose of deluding people like myself. So it was, as we would say today, a Potemkin factory or Potemkin village. the Times chose to make this report the foundation for an editorial. Here are a few extracts. The Soviet economic system is being slowly undermined by the unextinguished vital forces of Russia. They abandoned the communist experiment last year. Even the Cheka, the Extraordinary Commission, or the State Political Department, as it is now called, has lost much of its terror. If only. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.